And he holds an undergraduate degree in ecosystem analysis from Huxley College at Western Washington University, and is a master's graduate of the University Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. And for 25 years, he's been the owner and principal of Taylor Associates, which is a local firm specializing in aquatic environment studies, especially focused on stormwater monitoring and sustainability. And he's been a longtime supporter of the Water Center, and remains an employer of many UW students that have come through the Water Center over the 22 years in its various forms that it was in operation. And he's going to be speaking on results of hydrological monitoring of four green roofs in the Seattle area. And green roofs have certainly become popular in urban environments these days in terms of managing stormwater, creating a greener environment, and sort of being ecologically sustainable in terms of urban environmental ecology. So I'm very supportive of green roofs myself. There are certainly some critics who say maybe you can't keep them going, and what happens if they leak and all those other kinds of things. But I'm sure Bill's going to touch on this, and he's going to leave a few minutes for questions at the end.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So, Bill.
Okay, thank you.
I want to start on a personal note. I graduated from my master's program in 1990, and the Water Center was starting just at that time. And since then, I've been quite involved and seen a number of the directors come and go, and it's been very consistent. And as I said, as Professor Evans in the beginning, I've even hired a number of students, and we've been very successful. So I want to say to all the directors past, and Professor Evans and Debbie Livingston also, thank you for leading the program. It's been a real contribution to the university, so thank you for that. And I do hope that something does come a little similar to this program that we can stick with. I want to recognize our team members from my office and from outside the office. This is a program that we have been doing for the city of Seattle, and our team members from my office include Kurt Marks, Brian Bercompas, and Heidi Walker. Brian is, by the way, about a 1994 graduate of the Water Center. And Heidi Walker has been our program manager. We also have participation from Doug Beierlein, who is one of the local, very, very well-established and respected modelers. And he helped us establish some of the parameters and set up for the program so that later modeling can be done. And Bob Spencer was the City of Seattle project manager. Now, I also want to ask, this is the last presentation of the year, how many of you are graduating this quarter? Nice. Okay, and of you, how many of you are more on the sciences side of environmental management? Well, we've got a big cross-section of a variety of people, nobody else. How about more on the policy or legal side of? Okay, very good. I want to make the point that as any of you get involved in environmental management, the sciences side and the policy side have got to meet in the middle and reach an understanding, seek for understanding between those disciplines, because there's a lot of disciplinary orientation that you start with. But as you get into your career, there's a lot of crossover, a lot of questions, and there's a middle ground that needs to be found. And that middle ground is where solutions in sustainability especially are going to come from. None of it is cut and dry, but we have to search for understanding to make those decisions and move forward. Let's see, and see if it gets it from here. Okay. And to that point, green roofs are a case in point. They have a number of benefits. These are the common ones. The one most thought of is ameliorating stormwater runoff. They also have benefits for heating and cooling, energy reduction, aesthetic enjoyment, art, and even possibly health benefits. Except for the people that need to go for their smoke break and go up and go outside and have their smoke break on the green roof.
reducing air pollution and providing urban wildlife islands for habitat and biodiversity.
Just like any of the other sustainable designs, a big part of all of these benefits is to make urban centers more efficient in their existing infrastructure and more attractive to live in, to essentially have higher density of population and reduce the stress on spreading out in other lesser impacted lands. That's the main goal of sustainable design. What started this project is the City of Seattle's concern for how much of their stormwater, especially downtown, but many other places, how much of their stormwater goes into combined sewers and ends up during storm events going to the treatment plant. And they end up treating at the treatment plant stormwater. Treatment plants are very expensive to treat water. When they have to send big storms to the treatment plant, King County, that owns the treatment plant, charges them by the volume, by the gallon. So if they can reduce the frequency and volume of their combined sewer overflows, they'll save money.
The purpose today is to show you what you can expect in source control from green roofs. What you'll see is that there are still a number of questions about how they perform, and what this will lead to is modeling that will get us into a little finer resolution in evaluating how those green roofs perform and get an idea of what kind of distribution of green roofs you need to have an effect in this particular case. Two things to remember. Green roofs are going to respond hydrically just like any soil-based system that you would find out in the land. It has to do with the seasonal meteorology, especially evapotranspiration, rainfall depth, intensity, duration, antecedent dry period, and secondly, the soil system. What's the vendor's soil system, the soil structure, slope, length, et cetera. And when I say the vendor's soil system, that's not only the soil structure, but they have the artificial components that have to facilitate drainage underneath it. And there are many different vendor types that are sold and utilized. And that those different vendor types have an effect as well as the soil system itself. The second thing is the monitoring instrumentation and measurement resolution is very important to the results. We'll get into a little bit of some techie speak on the measurement instrumentation that we use. And if you like instrumentation and how to get finer level resolution measurements, this is a topic for you. But it's very important. A lot of these systems are intended to have an effect on the hydrograph coming off of them to attenuate that flow. So instead of having a very high peak and very fast falling limb of the hydrograph, you have a lower peak and a drawn out limb of the hydrograph. That lower end of the hydrograph actually has a lot more of the water in it than conventional systems, than impervious systems. So if you want to get a good mass balance on the hydrologic response, you need to be able to measure those low flows at the low end of the hydrograph. Oops. Okay.
Here's how we started the monitoring. The approach is to do a hydrologic mass balance. That means try to get a measurement of the total amount of water coming in terms of rainfall, and all of the water going out in the main components of runoff and evapotranspiration. The inputs, of course, rainfall and irrigation. There can be irrigation on these systems. And evapotranspiration is not the only thing that was not measured directly.
That is a challenging parameter to measure. It can be calculated using
air temperature, relative humidity, solar radiation, and wind. As part of this, I also wrote guidelines that the city has now got in place for future monitoring, and we'll be doing more monitoring starting this summer and into the fall. The secondary parameters we have done some of, but are not required as part of the hydrologic mass balance. And if later you want to ask questions about water quality, we can talk about water quality as well. I don't have that in the slides, but there are some simple concepts there too.
Soil moisture is not necessarily required, but this will be an important part of evaluating the different soil systems, because the different soil systems and their water content holding capacity is the important part of how they respond to antecedent dry conditions and regenerating their water holding capacity in between storms. So we did put out soil moisture meters and have an idea of how the soil moisture changes. The four green roofs that we monitored were the Zoomasium, Ballard Public Library, Ross Park Shelter House, and Fire Station 10. The next one that we're going to start measuring is the Seattle Center parking garage. What's interesting about that one is it's a big space, and I'll talk about that here in a little bit as well. So here's an example setup of how we monitor the runoff. This is the Zoomasium. It's a new building at the zoo. Very fun. If you haven't been there, if you have kids, take your kids there. It's very fun. We set up a full weather station that had all the meteorological parameters, humidity, insulation, temperature, wind speed, and direction. And the green roof is up here above this roof gutter. Here's a view of it. It's somewhat convex. It's an unusual design. One thing to note about green roofs is that the architects are very enthusiastic about them. It just brings a whole nother component to their design that they get to play with. And the different green roof designs are very attractive. They can be very interesting. They do, as a result, have an effect on how they perform, and possibly even maintenance, but the architectural component of it is very attractive. So the way this flow coming off of the roof occurred is it flowed off the edge of the roof and into this very large gutter. It had three downspouts. You can see the remains of one here, and there's one at the other end. And what we did was put standpipes in the gutter so that as it filled up, it couldn't flow out the ends, and it all built up in the gutter and had to go down the one central downspout. It then flowed down this pipe and is constrained at the end by valves that allows this pipe to be full. So it's a pipe full flow, and it goes through an electromagnetic water meter, flow meter right here in the line. Has to be pipe full flow to function. And at the end, it comes out and goes down through a tipping bucket flow meter. Now, this is the same concept as a tipping bucket rain gauge. Tipping bucket rain gauge has got, it's like a little teeter-totter. It's got two little buckets that pivots on an axis. And when it's on one side, the water comes down and fills up the bucket. And as it fills and reaches a calibrated volume, it tips. And that volume then is recorded as a tip electronically. And in the electronic recording system, it is tipping as it fills and dispenses. This meter is then, instead of a small one, the tipping bucket rain gauge is about, the little meter is about this big. This one inside here is obviously larger, and it holds about 200 milliliters. And what you can do then for the low flow measurement is see how long that 200 milliliters takes to fill. And you can get resolution down to whatever duration it took to get that meter, that tipping bucket to tip. So it could be 200 milliliters in 5 minutes, tip. 200 milliliters in the next 10 minutes, tip. It's very, very low resolution, very fine, very repeatable.
and we calibrate it to be very accurate and precise. So what we have is this meter measures higher flows. It works best at higher flows, and it doesn't work so well at lower flows. So what you have is redundant systems that cover different ranges of the flow. And when they overlap, one of them is no longer so accurate, and you go to the record from the other one, and vice versa. Here's the Ballard Public Library. This is another common part of getting to be more of a common part of green roofs, and that's access, just to go up there. We did not do an evaluation of the Justice Center downtown. There's a new Justice Center green roof, and there's one at City Hall. Justice Center green roof has access from the floor. You can go up on your breaks or what have you, and they've got benches and whatnot to spend your lunch hour out there. It's very nice. This one was more challenging to monitor. This one is a little bit more concave, and the flows come down to this central drainage line that has six downspouts. Now, these were just flush in the drainage path. So the question was, how are we going to measure water going to a hole and just spilling into the hole? It was, hydraulically speaking, it was going to be a challenge. What we did was, and this was Kurt Marks at our office, came up with these hydraulic primary devices that he designed and calibrated actually here at the University Hydraulics Laboratory. And the way these work is this is an insert that goes down into the downspout. It's got a dead end, which means that as the water pours down into this, that standpipe is going to fill. And as it fills, it's pouring out those calibrated holes on the side. The hole on the bottom is smallest, hole on the top largest, and that way we were able to monitor just the stage. Stage is just the elevation of the water in that standpipe, and have a stage discharge relationship between the stage in there and how much water was coming out those holes on the side. Again, very fine resolution trying to get those measurements. The other one is actually a retrofit to go on top of what was the secondary set of downspouts, which are the emergency or overflow downspouts. And the way this works is that it's actually sticking up above the ground, and it's in the design of a roof like this, you always have to have emergency overflows. You have to have a backup system. This was to be ready to measure flow if the water backed up on the roof and needed to go in those backup overflow systems. These are in the sides of this standpipe, calibrated V-notch weirs. And we've measured stage on the outside of those so that if water did start to pool and go over those, we'd be measuring that as well with the stage discharge relationship that we calibrated between these V-notch weirs and stage. It was interesting. Right now we're in a transition between conventional roofs and green roofs. This is going to be a big challenge, and we can talk about this later in question time, but it is going to be a big challenge going from conventional approaches to new approaches. And what we have is a lot of businesses, essentially a lot of infrastructure that is vested in conventional ways of doing things. And we had to go and talk to the mechanical engineer of this building to tell him what we were going to do for monitoring, and we were telling him that we may be ponding more water on his roof. He did not like that. We had to go through the city of Seattle to have the city building department certify that the building was strong enough to do something different with the downspouts. So there's a lot of design consideration that the engineers and the building department people will have to go through to be comfortable with implementing these new design approaches. There are a lot of people that have 20 and 30 years in doing engineering and building design and building permitting in the conventional approaches, and they need help to understand how these systems can work.
Here's the Ross Park Shelter House. This one is interesting in that
there were two parts to the roof. There was a green roof and a conventional roof, side by side. They're relatively small compared to the other ones.
But you can see there are two downspouts here, and one each is coming from
one of those two roofs, conventional green roof.
They are coming down into a similar system as I described before, but instead of an electromagnetic water meter, there's a flume under there for the higher flows.
Again, it's a primary device. Primary device means it's geometrically designed and well-used flow measurement instrument, such as a flume, a weir,
principally those two,
flumes and weirs, or constrictions that are flumes, that when you have just stage measurement, you get a good flow measurement.
So there's a flume in here, and also again the
tipping bucket flow meter.
And a complete weather station again. This one is fire station 10,
same thing. The one interesting thing about this roof is that, again, there were two green roofs, but one of them had more of a V-shaped geometry to it with the drainage line through the middle, and the other was more of an overall plane to one edge and had flow collected in the one edge for the entire area. And we'll look at the data here in a minute, and there may be something reflected in the difference between those two geometries.
There is also irrigation. We're tracking irrigation.
There are some complications in measuring some of the inputs, and one of them came about on this one, and that is cooling water. Air conditioning makes a lot of water. It was actually quite surprising, and it introduced a confounding factor in our measurement of the hydrologic mass balance. We had a challenging time trying to get a way to measure how much. And we were talking at times, you know, fractions or whole gallons per minute, which is on the scale of where we're trying to measure and getting, and it's continuous, relatively continuous. Even during the winter, I don't know if you knew this, even during the winter, most buildings require cooling because of all the body heat and electronic equipment. So most of the time, buildings are being cooled, not heated even in the winter.
That remained something of a confounding factor, and we're not quite sure how to entirely deal with that. And now here's the Seattle Center parking garage. That's
coming next.
This is going to be large. This is 1.34 acres.
And what I'm predicting is that there may be a scale effect. Once we go from these relatively smaller green roofs, and I'm not sure where it's going to come from, what the nature of that scale effect is going to be, but once we start measuring it on a per unit basis, I'm expecting to see some different responses. And it could be just on the scale of it that it's more exposed. There are not any trees around it, whereas a couple of the others, they were quite shaded by trees. Just by a green roof this large not having that much shading, there's an example of possible shading and a scale effect.
So here's some of the results. This was the Zoomasium, and from February to March, which is the end of the wet season, we had 5.8 inches of rainfall. The measured volume coming off during that time through our system was about 20,000, almost 700 gallons.
We used the rational method, which is simply intensity times area with a coefficient depending on what kind of surface you're working with. That's the value C, to get an estimate of the total volume that would be seen on a conventional roof. That's called the rational method, CIA.
And we used a C value of 0.98.
Practically one, essentially, impervious.
And came up with this many gallons during that same period.
Given
the same rainfall. In comparing the green roof to the conventional roof, that would have been 73% of the volume, or a 27% reduction.
Now what happens, and this is seen quite a lot in the literature, is that you have, on the first big scale, a wet season versus dry season difference, a big difference. And that's simply because of the relatively smaller volume of storms and the interstorm antecedent dry periods that allow the green roof to regenerate its sponge effect, its water absorbing capacity.
So April to September, 8.87 inches, almost 16,000 gallons. We would have seen under a conventional roof 43,000 gallons. It's almost reversed. 37% of the runoff is what you saw off the green roof versus the conventional roof, or a 63% reduction. Then you go back to the wet season, October to December, 15 inches, 66,747 versus 74,000. Now at that time it's only, it's 90% of the total, or only a 10% reduction. Now that doesn't tell the entire story. That's on a volumetric basis. That doesn't start to tell you about any reduction of peaks in the hydrograph. Because if you think about it, you could have two identical single storm, two hydrographs. One's conventional roof, real high peak and shorter tail out, or a green roof that has a lesser peak but a long tail out. But in fact, they both have the same volume. Relatively, if the green roof is already soaking wet, they could have the same volume. The question is that, in this example, is that reduction in the peak important to reducing combined sewer overflows? So that's an example where volume tells one part of the story, but there's another part of the story. Overall then, you have 30 inches, 71% of the conventional roof is what we saw in the green roof, and 29% reduction. Now that shows the difference between, very prominently, the difference between wet season and dry season. Here's another way of looking at that same data. And this is using the continuous rainfall, and the cumulative volumetric curve that you would see off the green roof versus the conventional roof. You can see at this end, it's in the late winter. The two curves are fairly close together and respond very similarly. Once you get to summer, the green roof almost flatlines, and the conventional roof keeps increasing with each and every storm. If you pick out a couple storms, you can see that, so what I've mentioned before is that there's a big difference between wet season and dry season, but even within wet season and dry season, there are times when, for example, in the wet season, you could have a good long antecedent dry period, and a storm will behave more like a dry season storm because it got dried out. Everybody remember what happened this last January? 2 or 3 weeks, we had the wind coming from the weather coming from the north. It was dry and cold for about 3 weeks. At the end of that time, green roofs may very well perform well on a big storm.
But you still see in the summer with a big storm, here's an example, big storm in the middle of the summer, very little increase in runoff right there. What do you see on a conventional roof?
There's a big signal. And even though during the summer you have generally smaller storms, you can have thunderstorms, more intense storms, that do contribute to combined sewer overflows in the summertime. So here, even though combined sewer overflows are of greatest concern in the wintertime, here you could have had one, and maybe it was ameliorated there.
Here's another, here's another one. This is not nearly as intense, but the volume was still considerable off a conventional roof. Just a little uptick here on the green roof. Once you get into the winter again,
that moisture holding capacity gets taken up between storms, during storms. The potential evapotranspiration during the wintertime is very low in the Seattle area. It needs to be extremely dry for ET to make an impact on the green roof.
So you get these kind of storms here compared to in the summer. Here's this one.
here's a big uptick, just like you see in the conventional roof. Again, another relatively large storm, big uptick.
And it starts to mimic the conventional roof during the wintertime.
That doesn't bode extremely well for reducing combined sewer overflows.
Maybe, maybe not. That's where you start getting into doing modeling and seeing where, in fact, we do have times when it's dry enough that the roof does dry out enough that when the next storm comes along, it has an effect. And that's the question.
Here's Ross Park Shelter House, another example. November 26, it was relatively dry for approximately a week, 10 days before this. 0.25-inch storm with an intensity of 0.12. Now we're comparing just peak flows, not the volume, the peak runoff of the green roof versus the conventional roof. 6%. The green roof was 6% of the peak seen on the conventional roof. And this is in November. By the way, November is the wettest month of the year. This is around here. This is when you have most of these concerns for combined sewer overflows. Percent reduction, 94%. Just a few days later, and it remained relatively wet. The green roof's already kind of saturated. It's a big storm. The intensity is about the same. But because there was so much volume in that storm, and the sponge got soaked, the peak was 90% of the conventional roof. So on a very fine level resolution, you start seeing behavior of the runoff on a very short time scale, dependent on a number of factors, the antecedent dry conditions, and the volume and the intensity. So it's not a blanket, oh, they work all the time. Or they only work in the summer and they only work in the winter. It all depends, very much depends. That was only a 10% reduction. Fire station 10, conventional roof. There are two roofs here. One's called Emergency Operations Center, the other's Fire Station 10. Emergency Operations Center has it's
one long plane of the roof, and then there's a drain along one side.
The Fire Station 10 has more of a V-shaped pattern with the drain down the middle. In October, we did get a 0.3-inch storm. The peak of the runoff compared to a conventional roof was only 3%. Again, pretty considerable reduction. October, it's very dry still. The Fire Station 10 green roof, 8%. You get down to November 3rd, and you have some rain soaking the green roof ahead of time. 0.9-inch storm. Rainfall intensity is higher. Peak flow, 53% of the conventional roof and 65% of the conventional roof.
Big differences. And again, you can see these big differences even within the summer and within the winter. So what's next? We are continuing to sample at two of the roofs, and we'll be doing so through the summer and starting again in the winter.
The Seattle Center parking garage hopefully will be coming online this winter.
The financial situation hits everybody, and there's been a little bit of delay in getting this up and going.
And finally, what's most interesting is getting this model calibrated for evaluating what the effect would be of having different densities of green roofs in downtown Seattle. The modeling is going to be a 40-year continuous model that's calibrated based on the observations we've seen here with our test green roofs that calibrates the parameters. Then you plug in a 40-year rainfall record, and you get a large sample size of the variation in the climatological conditions that you see over years and over many winters and over many summers.
and you start to get down into some frequency analysis of how many times would you see a dry period in the winter that, under conventional terms, the next storm comes along and causes this combined sewer overflow. Green roof terms, they regenerate their sponge effect, their absorptive capacity. Next storm comes along, there's not a combined sewer overflow. Or at least it's not of the same magnitude, volume, that you would have seen under conventional terms. So once you get a larger sample size with the model that's calibrated, you can start asking these more detailed questions. That's going to be the more interesting part of it. Then you say, okay, what if we do, then you do the what-if scenarios with your model. What if we cover 10% of the downtown buildings, high-rises, with green roofs? Run the model. Okay, frequency of combined sewer overflows, minimal. And just a little bit of volume decrease. How about if you go 25% of the green of the roofs in downtown Seattle are green roofs? 50%, 75%. And then you start coming back around and start asking implementation questions. Can we really get 50% of the buildings covered with green roofs in downtown Seattle? That starts to get into the policy and incentives that would be underlying that transition from conventional roofs to green roofs. But it could be a big deal, because that's a, never mind the value to the city in terms of how much they have to pay for sending water to the wastewater treatment plant. The impacts on the receiving water are very significant. You get, when you have those big combined sewer overflows, the wastewater treatment plant is overtaxed, and it can't work as well as it's supposed to. And there are places where, if it overflows, it doesn't ever make it to the wastewater treatment plant. It combines with sewage, it spills over directly into the bay. Or in other places, into a nearby stream. So you get mixed sanitary and stormwater. It's going directly in the environment. So there, never mind the actual cost, there are the externalities of the real impacts in the receiving waters that you start to reduce. That's where the rub happens. That's when you start saying, well, gosh, can we do this? Is it really going to make that much difference? Well, what's the impact on the environment? What are the cost trade-offs? And that's why I asked at the beginning, how many of you were more in the sciences, how many in the policy side? That's when you get into rooms and you have people from all those disciplines sitting around the table saying, how are we going to hash this out? How are we going to make a decision based on these differences that are not clear cut?
Conclusions about hydrology. Green roofs reduce peak flow rates and total runoff.
To some extent, at times, more at others.
Green roofs are more effective during the dry season, but in any season, it depends on the antecedent conditions and the rainfall intensity and duration. Remaining question, what's the overall effectiveness of green roofs? Conduct long period modeling to evaluate the potential reduction in CSO frequency and duration. Now, I just read a new paper that came out this year. It's in Ecological Engineering. And this author did a nice job in summarizing a number of the factors from the literature that you have to take into account. And I read this, and I already knew what I wanted to say, but I wanted to bring another person's viewpoint. And she's saying the same thing. And this is, as you go forward in your careers, the folks here that are in environmental science, these are the questions that you're going to have to address. It's not clear cut, not simple. And there's a lot of change in the way we do things, in the way people do business, our own perception of what we think our lifestyle ought to be, and where we live, that are all the big questions that we have to address to make some of these infrastructure changes that we're talking about. So I'll take some questions.
So questions?
Well, excuse me.
Can we get, turn the light on here.
Can we get my glasses?
Up the back. Yep.
Sounds like 50% would be hard to do, so if we were kind of getting maybe more downspout disconnects, more downspout disconnects, more rain gardens, more pervious surfaces to sort of help mitigate the flow.
That's exactly right. Do you want to repeat the question?
Okay, thank you. So the question is, as I understand it, is if one solution like green roofs is not quite enough, or there are other combined solutions that in a cumulative manner make an effect, and that's right. And in different parts of the urban environment, different design approaches are available. So rain gardens in downtown Seattle, it'd be challenging. You start talking about a lot of tearing up existing impervious areas, sidewalks, parking lots, etc., and turning it into soil systems. Possible, again, you'd have to work on a large volume, large area basis. There are a number of disconnects that could happen. These buildings are also supposed to, and this is one topic I didn't talk about so much, and that is maintenance of these systems. This is another question mark in transitioning from the existing infrastructure that we're used to new sustainable infrastructures. What's the maintenance required? How do we work with these so that they operate on a long term? One of the existing systems that is in downtown is big detention vaults that are in the basement of these buildings. But they don't even know how much they are maintained and operated, if they're functioning properly or not. That's a first question, make sure that those kinds of systems are already operating. But the tendency is for a lot of these systems is to have a system that you build and walk away. You don't have to think about it anymore. That's part of the mindset that we have in the highly engineered systems, that we want to just fix something and walk away, and then we don't have to think about it anymore. So that's in selecting a number of different approaches, we're going to have to be ready to maintain them and keep them operating for them to contribute. Debbie.
Is there a minimum and a maximum soil depth that you need for a green roof?
There is a range of green roofs that's typical, from about 4 to 8 inches. And there's two general types of green roofs. One is extensive, which all these are, which is broad scale and relatively shallow. And intensive, which is more like big potting gardens that have trees, very, very deep soil systems. The extensive, which we're talking about here, much more common. There is, just logically speaking, you can expect that greater the depth, the greater the sponge effect, and the greater benefit. There's a little bit of, in some of the literature, there's some contention about that, but I think that is just based on a small sample size. As you saw, what I was trying to exhibit was that there's so much variation that if you only look at a few cases, you may very well come up with an incorrect conclusion. So that's a very good question. That's the typical depth. It's about 4 to 8 inches.
Any other questions, Ron?
Yeah, I was considering the whether this is going to be profitable for the people downtown that already have existing roofs. Are they going to be able to get tax breaks in order to in place these, and also they're going to have to be certified that they are structurally sound. Mm-hmm. Or
repeat the question.
Okay. So the question is, do the people that own the buildings downtown have incentives to, and let me know if I'm missing part of your question, incentives to do this transition to green roofs? Might there be tax breaks or other incentives? They do have, and I'm not very specifically knowledgeable of how they're taxed, but there is a stormwater utility tax. And part of the discussions between city and people that own these buildings is, hey, what's the incentive? Why should we go ahead and do this, even or especially in light of the fact that, gosh, we don't have an industry that really knows how to do this or what it's going to take, and are we going to run into engineering problems that cause us to have secondary costs later? So there's a fair bit of trepidation on the part of owners and on the part of vendors to make that leap, because we're going to be learning a lot as we do that. So the incentive question is a very important one just for that reason.
One more question.
Has anybody done the cost-benefit sort of analysis between doing this and doing other just sort of like basic improving the current infrastructure? I mean, this is obviously putting it on private landowners, right? And then charging into, you know, using incentives or whatnot to offset some of the individual costs. But I guess with things like this, I'm often concerned about the faddishness, right? So just with kind of basic trust and well-known things that will also solve the problem, has anybody actually done the cost-benefit analysis and seen updating this stuff would actually accommodate the flows?
I'm sure there's been... Okay, the question is, has there been a cost-benefit analysis done on comparing... And I'm trying to work your faddish part of the question. Comparing what it would look like to keep things as they are versus adding some of these, and is there some faddish or popularity in some of these designs that doesn't really reflect the benefit or the cost involved? Is that what you're
getting at? And we might be able to update the current infrastructure in more effective ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have not gotten into the cost-benefit analysis. I know that they're out there. It remains... What I would say is that the benefit part is relatively unclear, and so people... My sense is that a lot of people that are both in the public sector and private sector are not rushing to this. They're not seeing it as immediately beneficial at a really inexpensive cost. It's not right there, and you'd probably be doing it more quickly if it was. I'd say we have to get into that more, and hopefully the modeling for this will do that. Thank you, everybody.